Pranavasesha Utsrishto.
Pranavasesha Utsrishto.
Dvibhihata Balaprapa.
Dvibhihata Balaprapa.
Smaran Virupa Karanam.
Smaran Virupa Karanam.
Tatma Manorata.
Tatma Manorata.
Chakre Bojo Katam Nama.
Chakre Bojo Katam Nama.
Nivasaya Mahatpuram.
Nivasaya Mahatpuram.
Pranavasesha Utsrishto.
Pranavasesha Utsrishto.
Vibhihata Balaprapa.
Vibhihata Balaprapa.
Smaran Virupa Karanam.
Smaran Virupa Karanam.
Tatatma Manorata.
Vidatma Manorata.
Chakre Boja Katam Nama.
Chakre Boja Katam Nama.
Nivasaya Mahatpuram.
Nivasaya Mahatpuram.
Pranavasesha Utsrishto.
Pranavasesha Utsrishto.
Vibhihata Balaprapa.
Vibhihata.
Prana.
Prana.
His life air.
His life air.
Avasesha.
Avasesha.
Remaining only.
Remaining only.
Utsrishta.
Utsrishta.
Expelled.
Expelled.
Dvidbi.
Dvidbi.
By his enemies.
By his enemies.
Hata.
Hata.
Destroyed.
Destroyed.
Ambala.
Bala.
His strength.
His strength.
Prabha.
Prabha.
The bodily effulgence.
The bodily effulgence.
Smaran.
Smaran.
Remembering.
Remembering.
Virupa Karanam.
Virupa Karanam.
His disfigurement.
His disfigurement.
Vitata.
Vitata.
Frustrated.
Frustrated.
Atma.
Atma.
His personal.
His personal.
Manarata.
Manarata.
Desires.
Desires.
Chakre.
Chakre.
He made.
He made.
Bojakatamma nama.
Bojakatamma nama.
Named Bojakata.
Named Bojakata.
Nivasaya.
Nivasaya.
For his residence.
For his residence.
Mahat.
Mahat.
Large.
Large.
Puram.
Puram.
A city.
A city.
Translation and purports by the followers of Srila Prabhupada. Left only with his life air, cast out by his enemies and deprived of his strength and bodily radiance, Rukmi could not forget how he had been disfigured. In frustration, he constructed. In frustration, he constructed for his residence. Oh, sorry. In frustration, he constructed for his residence a large city, which he called Bojakata. Translation responsibly. Left with only his life air.
Left with only his life air.
Cast out by his enemies.
Cast out by his enemies.
And deprived of his strength.
And deprived of his strength.
And bodily radiance.
And bodily radiance.
Rukmi could not forget.
Rukmi could not forget.
How he had been disfigured.
How he had been disfigured.
In frustration.
In frustration.
He constructed for his residence.
He constructed for his residence.
A large city.
A large city.
Which he called Bojakata.
Which he called Bojakata.
So I'm just going to read through to the end of the chapter, because there's not many purports in the end. So tomorrow we'll do them. Next. Because he had promised, I will not re-enter Kundina until I have killed wicked Krishna and brought back my younger sister, in a mood of angry frustration, Rukmi took up residence at that very place. Purport. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti explains that the word Bhoja means experience, and that Kata, according to the Nanarta Varga dictionary, means vow. Thus, Bhoja Kata is the place where Rukmi experienced misery as a result of his vow. Text 53. Thus, defeating all the opposing kings, the Supreme Personality of Godhead brought the daughter of Bhishmaka to his capital and married her according to the Vedic injunctions. O protector of the Kurus. At that time, O King, there was a great rejoicing in all the homes of Yadu Puri, whose citizens loved only Krishna, chief of the Yadus. All the men and women, full of joy and adorned with shining jewels and earrings, brought wedding presents, which they reverently offered to the exquisitely dressed groom and bride. The city of the Vrishnis appeared most beautiful. There were tall, festive columns and also archways decorated with flower garlands, cloth banners and precious gems. Arrangements of auspicious, full water pots, a guru, scented incense, and lamps graced every doorway. The city streets were cleansed by the intoxicated elephants belonging to the beloved kings who were guests at the wedding. And these elephants further enhanced the beauty of the city by placing trunks of plantain and betel nut trees in all the doorways. Those who belonged to the royal families of the Kuru, Srinjaya, Kaikeya, Vidarbha, Yadu and Kunti clans joyfully met one another in the midst of the crowds of people excitedly running here and there. The king and their daughters were totally astonished to hear the story of Rukmini's abduction, which was being glorified in song everywhere. Dwarka's citizens were overjoyed to see Krishna, the lord of all opulence, united with Rukmini, the goddess of fortune. Thus end the purports of the humble servants of His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada to the 10th canto, 54th chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled The Marriage of Krishna and Rukmini. Omigyan timirandasya ginanjana shalakaya chakshun militam jena tasmai Sri Gurave namaha. Sri Chaitanya Manobishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swa Padantikam Vancha Kalpatu Rubyascha Kripa Sindubhyevacha Petitanam Bhavanebhyo Vaishna Vebhyo Namo Namaha. Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Shri Vasari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So it mentions here that read a long section, so let's go back. So it mentions here that Rukmi is the brother of Rukmini, who is the daughter and son of King Bhishmaka, right? So, Rukmi and Rukmini are born in the same family. But it's not always that people of the same family have the same disposition. And we see that, right? It is described that in Satya Yuga, generally the demons and the devotees would be born on different planets. So you'll hear in the Srimad Bhagavatam, sometimes you'll see there's pastimes where the demons attack the devas, right? And they have to fly up past Earth because the demons live below Earth in lower planetary, so subterranean heavenly planets, right? Describes in the Srimad Bhagavatam that the planets of the demons, the subterranean heavenly planets which are below Earth, are even more opulent than the heavenly planets, than Svarga. But it says that the light of the sun does not reach that place. The sun's rays do not reach that place like that. So therefore, in order to light up the subterranean heavenly realms, the nagas or the snakes, like remember Krishna fought with one snake? What was his name? Kaliya. So Kaliya, on the hoods of the snakes they have jewels, like big rubies, like that, right in their center, and they are effulgent. So in the subterranean heavenly planets, the subterranean heavenly planets are illuminated by all the jewels from the hoods of the nagas, the snakes, like that. So, but in the subterranean heavenly planets, it is even more opulent than the heavenly planets. So then when the demons, because the nature of a demon is that he is never satisfied. This is said in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. What is that verse? Yeah. Krishna Bhakta Nishkama Ata Eva Shanta Bhukti Mukti Siddhi Kami Sakale Oshanto. That a Krishna Bhakta or a devotee is Nishkama. Now, what does Nishkama mean? Free from?
Desires,
right? He doesn't have desires. Right? Does it mean he doesn't have desires? No, nishkama means he doesn't have material desires. A devotee does not have material desires. Right? At least an advanced devotee does not have material desires. Right? You see how advanced you are. You can tell how advanced you are by how many material desires you have. Right? The less material desires you have, the more advanced you are as a devotee. That's very simple. Prabhupada mentions this in the Krishna book. In the chapters about the gopis and Krishna. He says that the more you become attached to Krishna and the less you become attached to the material energy, then you are advancing. You can tell if you're making advancement, you're becoming more attached to Krishna and less attached to Maya. Or sometimes it goes the other way. Right? Sometimes you feel like you're becoming more attached to Maya and less attached to Krishna. Like that. So sometimes it goes both ways, right? But we see that's how you can tangibly tell if you're making spiritual advancement. So a devotee is nishkama. Nishkama means he doesn't have material desires, and therefore ato eva shanta. What does shanta mean?
Peaceful.
Peaceful. Devotee is peaceful, because he does not have material desires. But bhukti, mukti, siddhi, kami. Right? Bhukti, right, means materialists, right? It means karmas, what we usually call karmis. So those who are materialists. Bhukti, mukti means jnanis, those who want mukti, who want liberation. Siddhi means yogis who want mystic potencies, there's eight types of mystic potencies who want these different siddhis like that. So materialists, jnanis and yogis, bhukti, mukti, siddhi, kami, because they have kami or desires, because they have karma or desires, sakale ashanta. Ashanta means they're never peaceful. Right? You're never peaceful when you have material desires. Material desires make your consciousness agitated. And therefore you don't find peace. You never have peace of mind. As long as there's material desires within the consciousness, you never find peace. Just like in the seventh canto of the Bhagavatam, there's the story of Prahlad Maharaj and Hiranyakashipu. So Prahlad was a great bhakta. He was a parama bhakti. He's like the supreme devotee. He's like pure. He's only 5 years old. Right? 5 years old, and he just had complete love for Krishna. He's totally Krishna conscious. Five-year-old children, you don't see a totally Krishna conscious. Five-year-old children are running here and there and breaking things and just totally, their consciousness is scattered. But he was so elevated, he was just fully fixed on Krishna. So he's sitting on the lap of his father and he was preaching to his father. They were having a conversation. And he said to his father, "You've conquered the universe." Right? Hiranyakashipu was so powerful that when he just moved his eyebrows, right? If he became a little angry and he just moved his eyebrows, Indra would begin to tremble. Right? Lord Indra would just tremble. You know, he's getting angry like that. Right? Hiranyakashipu, every morning, he would make Indra carry his slippers, his padukas, right, his slippers on his head and put him on his feet. Right? Hiranyakashipu, "Indra, where is my slippers?" Right? And if Indra wasn't quick and he saw his eyebrows, he was getting angry, Indra would begin to tremble. Like that. That's how powerful Hiranyakashipu was. Conquered the universe. The whole universe was under his control. So Prahlad sat on his lap and said, "You've conquered the whole universe, but you have not conquered your senses." Right? You have not conquered lust. Therefore, you are not peaceful. You've conquered everything, but still you're not peaceful, still you're not satisfied, still you want more. At Prahlad Maharaj's preaching to Hiranyakashipu, this is the nature of material desires. Right? The more you have material desires and the more you try to satisfy them, the greater they get. Krishna explains this in the Bhagavad Gita. It is like fire. He says karma or lust or material desires like fire. The more you feed it, the stronger it gets. That's why we practice four regulative principles. No meat eating, no illicit sex, no intoxication, no gambling. Why? Why do we have restriction? Because you have to abstain from those things. That's why in Vedic culture, if you look at the Varnashram system, what is the division in the ashram? Right? What makes the differences in the different ashrams? There's four different ashrams, but what is the difference between them? What's it based upon? Yeah, that's true. But there's an even deeper difference which defines them.
Renunciation.
Yeah, renunciation. Yeah, that's true. Like that. But yeah, sex. Right, it's all based on sex. One ashram can have sex, right, under license, right, illicit sex, right, and the other ashrams cannot have sex, right. So it's based on material desires. Right? That's the division. Right? That's what makes everything divided within the material world. So, the more one tries to satisfy one's material desires, the more one will become disturbed. So therefore, in Vedic culture, right, there is abstinence of material desires. Right? You have to, just like in Vedic culture, you're trained, first of all, as a brahmachari. Right? What is the purpose of brahmachari or brahmacharini training? Right? It is to teach you to learn to control your senses. Right? And in order to learn to control your senses, you have to abstain from association with the opposite sex. You know, it's nonsense that the brahmacharis and brahmacharinis are whimsically associating with each other. That's nonsense. Just like, you know, we've heard, you know, in recent times, I won't say where, on earth, you know, I won't say on which place in earth, but everyone will work it out pretty quickly. Right? I've heard of brahmacharis and brahmacharinis sending text messages to each other. Right? That's called nonsense number one. You know, get a big black texture and put on your head, number one. I'm nonsense number one. Right? It's nonsense. Right? Brahmacharis and brahmacharis are not meant to associate intimately. For service, there may be something, but that's it. You know, when I was a brahmachari, there's no such thing as sending text messages to brahmacharinis. We didn't even have mobile phones. Now everyone's got a mobile phone. Interesting, because in Chalpati recently, Radhanath Swami said to all the brahmacharis, how many brahmacharis are there now in Chalpati? Don't know. When I was there, it was about 70 or 80 or something. I think now it's like 120 or, I don't know, but maybe there's 250 or... Maybe there's 5,000. Every time I go there, it's bigger. Do you know how many there is?
Around
100. Around 100. Yeah, 100. So Radhanath Swami said to them recently, he said, just try to live without your laptop computers. He didn't say you had to do it. He didn't say, okay, renounce it. Because, you know, yukta vairagya means we use it. He said, see if you can live without it. See if you can live without it. So this is the nature of devotee. Devotee is simplistic. And we're taught within Vedic culture to control our senses. Right? And that's the thing with all these modern things. They agitate people's senses. Just like, you know, you walk through the city and you see everyone like walking down the street on the mobile phone. Right? And totally agitated. Right? You can't even, you see people texting constantly. You know, consciousness is so agitated. All these modern facilities and so forth, they just agitate our consciousness. That's why Prabhupada said the farm communities, you know, if ISKCON can, you know, we haven't done it greatly yet. There's a few farms around the world which are really working, but there's not many. But Prabhupada wanted farm communities for an ideal example where devotees can live a Vedic lifestyle, means simplistic, right? Without all of the modern conveniences, right? Without all the things that that agitate the consciousness. Just live a very simple life and think about Krishna. Right, that's the goal of life. So ashram is meant to train it. Vedic culture is meant to train us in that. that we're meant to practice brahmachari brahmacharini life to become strict in our sense control so that we can focus the consciousness upon Krishna. Because the nature of material desires is the more you feed it, the stronger it will become. Right? So therefore, in Vedic culture, because we're conditioned souls, we follow Varnashram culture. And Varnashram culture means that we follow rules and regulations and we follow etiquettes in order to assist us in dissolving our material attachments. Right? Because if you're trying to give up attachment to the opposite sex and you're constantly engaged in association with the opposite sex, how will you do it? Not possible. Therefore, we have segregation. Therefore, the men and women, when we take prasadam, we sit separately. When we chant japa, we sit separately. Right? When we have class, we sit separately. That's our culture. Right? Because that assists one in controlling the mind, controlling the senses. Why? So you can think of Krishna. Right? Otherwise, it's not possible. It's very difficult for a conditioned soul. Unless you're a liberated soul, then you can do it. Just like in the Bhagavatam, you see Lord Shiva was giving Bhagavatam class and Parvati was sitting on the lap. Right? Imagine if Vedapri was sitting in my lap. Right? And I'm trying to give a very serious class and everyone's like, what's this about? It doesn't make sense. Right? It's ridiculous. But for Shiva, he can do it. Right? He was sitting there and the sages were sober. Right? He had all the sages sitting in front of him and everyone was sober. Right? But then Chitraketu Maharaj flew overhead and he looked down and then he saw Parvati was sitting on Shiva's lap. And he smiled. Right? Not because he thought anything, but he knew Lord Shiva's position. He knew Lord Shiva was Vaishnavanam Yathashambhu. He's the greatest Vaishnava. So he didn't think anything bad about Shiva, but he just smiled because it was very funny. You know, Lord Shiva's sitting there with Parvati on his lap and he's giving Bhagavatam class. So he smiled and Parvati looked up and she thought that Chitraketu Maharaj was making fun of Shiva, so she cursed him. You will take birth in a demoniac family. Then that's how the whole pastime of Vritrasura took place. Like that. So, if one does not control one's material desires, one's material attachments, right, then one cannot focus on Krishna. Only a devotee can focus on Krishna. Right? Therefore, he's nishkama. That means he is free from material desires. Now, it is not by abstinence alone that you can learn to focus on Krishna. Krishna teaches this within the Bhagavad Gita. In the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, 59th verse, this is one of the key verses of the Bhagavad Gita. Param drishtva nivartate. Right? It says that the taste for sense objects may remain for a conditioned soul. Right? We have attachment to material activities. Even though we're devotees, we've not fully transcended our attachments to the material activities, to the material energy. But Krishna says that by experiencing a higher taste, you refrain from activities. In other words, our process is not the process of abstinence. That's not our process. You don't see that in the teachings of the Goswamis. What Rupa Goswami teaches is yukta vairagya. Right? Krishna nirbanda, Krishna sambande, yukta vairagya uchate. Right? That in order to control the senses, you have to engage what you would normally use for your sense gratification, engage that in the service of Krishna. And in that way you become detached from that same thing. This example is also given in the Bhagavatam, I think by Prahlad Maharaj. He says that if you have a thorn in your hand, that thorn is the cause of your suffering. So what is the cause of our suffering in this material world? Is attachment to the opposite sex. That is the cause of our suffering. That's why we stay in this material world. So that is the cause of your suffering, the thorn. So I think it's Prahlad Maharaj, I can't remember. It's in the Bhagavatam. He says, so what do you do? How do you get out the thorn? You take another thorn and then you take it out. So the thing that is causing your suffering can also relieve your suffering. So the same things that attach you to this material world and keep you bound in this material world can liberate you from this material world if they're used in the service of Krishna. So therefore, if you're attached to the opposite sex, what do you get? What do? You get married. Right? You get married. if you can find someone. Usually takes about 5 to 10 years. Krishna sees the austerity. You have to understand that. Krishna sees the austerity. It's hard to find a partner in this world because there's 6 billion human beings on this planet and not many of them are Krishna conscious. So it's very hard for the devotees to find a partner sometimes. Not always, but sometimes it is. But understand, you're going through your mental anguish and your mental anxiety because you can't find a partner, and Krishna sees it. You know, Krishna's a person and he feels, he compassionately feels sympathy for your position. And he will protect you. Don't think, even though it's difficult, he will protect you. He'll look after you. And he'll send someone in due course of time. But he doesn't have so many people to send. Not that he doesn't want to send anyone. He hasn't got many people to send. Who's he going to send? Yeah, he's in the spiritual world. He says the giant Vijay. Okay, someone needs to get married. Go and marry. You can't do that. It doesn't work like that. But the point is that if you want to overcome your attachment to sex, then you have to go into the Grihastha ashram. And the same thing which normally binds you to this world can liberate you from this world. So therefore, it is stated within the Bhagavatam, I think in Canto 4, Canto 3 or Canto 4, there's some verses which glorify the wife. And the Bhagavatam says, the wife is the source of liberation for the husband from this material world. I remember when I first joined the temple and I moved into the Brahmacharya ashram, and the Brahmacharyas would say all sorts of mantras. Women are Maya. Yeah, that was the main one. Yeah, women are Maya, right? And then they say all these other things, you know, which extend from that. You know, like, you know, when you see a Mataji, you should spit. You know, because, you know, you should be so disgusted with the material energy. I was actually told these things. And I don't know, I think I was fairly normal when I became a devotee. I think I was. I mean, I don't know if I was, but... Huh? I think I was. I don't know. I mean, I'm not going to judge. Maybe I was totally abnormal. But I think I was a fairly normal person when I joined. But then you become a devotee for a couple of years and you turn weird. You know, you start being this, like, weird creature that, like, you know, women are like the personification of Maya and the material energy, and they're like... And then the Bhagavatam has some verses in the fifth canto which says the women are like jackals. Right? They suck the blood. Right? And tigers, they suck the blood of the husband. Right? I mean, so that's the kind of thing you get fed when you join, and then you start getting all these abnormal kind of, you know, thought patterns going on. And then it takes you about, you know, 15 years to work out how to relate to the opposite sex like a normal person once again, like that. So it's not very good training. It's not very good training. It's very fanatical, it's very imbalanced, and it's ignorant, actually. It's not good training. ISKCON's a lot better now. It's a lot better. Usually when the brahmacharis join up, you may hear some things like that, but it's not generally the tone that we take when we induct or teach new devotees. That's not the mood. The mood is there should be respect for the mothers, right? That is the mood. The women must always be protected. Under all circumstances, the women must be protected, right? Vedic culture falls apart, right, when brahmanas, cows, old people, children and women are neglected or abused. Right? So the women must always be protected. That is the duty, right, of the men in the movement. Right? They must always protect the manajis like that, spiritually and materially as much as possible. Right? So that is the mood within Vedic culture. So it says within the Bhagavatam, there are verses, although the Bhagavatam says certain things, but it also says the wife becomes the source of liberation. Because if the wife is Krishna conscious, and she can help the husband to control his senses and overcome his material attachments. And then if the husband is very strong, right, and very fixed in Krishna consciousness, that combination will liberate both of them beyond the material energy, take them back to Godhead. So the same thing which can cause bondage in the material world can also liberate us from the material world. It's just a matter of what our consciousness is. So this is our philosophy. Right? Not that we don't preach abstinence or we don't preach renunciation purely. You know, Vairagya is a part of our teaching, but it's not the main way that we get purified is by absorbing our consciousness in Krishna's service, right? And that's the actual way to overcome your material desires, right? You have to absorb your consciousness in Krishna's service, right? You have to use your mind, your body, and your words in the service of Krishna, and that will purify you, your senses, purify your mind, purify your body. And in this way, you can make advancement and go beyond the material energy. That's the actual process of Krishna consciousness. That's what, therefore, Krishna says in the Gita, param drishtva nibhata. You have to get a param drishtva, which means a superior taste, from primarily from chanting Hare Krishna. Right? There's the most important way to overcome your material desires is to chant Hare Krishna. So it means that has to be our main focus of our life, is to cultivate our chanting. Right? When we chant, our chanting has to become very pure. Right? It has to become very fixed, like that. Just like you'll see in the morning when you look around and you'll see the devotees. I remember Tamal Krishna Maharaj said this one time in a lecture many years ago. He said that pretty much you can tell how advanced a devotee is just by looking at them when they chant their japa. Right? Because you'll see when they're chanting their japa, you can see how absorbed they are in tasting the holy name. Right? So you'll see when devotees chant, there's all sorts of levels of consciousness while devotees are chanting. Right? You see some devotees chanting, then like that. Right? That's not tasting the holy name. Right? I don't know what that's tasting, but it's not tasting the holy name. And then there's the other, like, you know, like the devotees are chanting, but their eyes are like. Like chanting, but they're not really there. You know, the consciousness is not there. It's not chanting. You're not tasting the holy name. You know, your mind's just totally absorbed. Sometimes you look at devotees chanting, like they're like this for like 2 hours, practically, just like. It's not. They're not absorbed in the holy name. The holy name. You should be relishing the holy name, tasting the holy name, and you have to develop a taste for the holy name. There's no choice but to taste the holy name, because that is the yuga dharma. That is the way you become God conscious in the age of Kali. Kali Kali Nama Rupe Krishna Avatar. The incarnation of Krishna in the Kali Yuga is the form of the holy name. Right? The Nama Rupe. So therefore we have to learn to have a taste for the holy name. That is how we overcome our attachment. So how do you get a taste for the holy name? By attentive chanting. You have to chant attentively. You have to make your chanting very fixed and very focused. And you have to associate with devotees who have that taste. Right? If you try to develop a taste for your holy name by yourself, it may be very difficult. So you have to seek out devotees who have a taste and chant in their association and get taste for chanting. Just like Bhakta Prabhu was saying a few weeks back in one of his classes, he said that he's never seen in the Melbourne temple such a array of devotees who have a taste for chanting the holy name. When you come into the temple in the morning for the men, and we chant in the temple, right? And sometimes, you know, when I'm chanting and my mind begins to wander, and then I open my eyes and I look around, then I see so many devotees who are absorbed in chanting, right? And then I hit my mind once again and I say, hey, what are you doing? Your mind's wandering. Get back into your chanting. But you see so many devotees who fix their taste for chanting seriously, right? And that uplifts the consciousness. And we have to, it's a service to the other devotees to help them come to that platform. If you see a devotee falling asleep during japa period, what do? Yeah, wow, wake him up. What a strange concept. We actually go and wake someone up. Ooh, that's weird, isn't it? Yeah, that's what we're supposed to do. Right? If someone's falling asleep, you go and wake them up. Right? You just go and rub them on the shoulder and say, hey, Prabhu, you're falling asleep. Come on, don't fall asleep in japa. It's maya to fall asleep in japa. Right? But sometimes you'll see a devotee might be falling asleep and the other devotee's just, you know, walking around Tulsi, you know, for 10, 15 minutes and the devotee's just gone. Yeah, he probably chanted about 2 mantras in 15 minutes, that guy. You know, so you go to that devotee and say, why don't you walk around? Right? Get up and walk around. It's maya to, Prabhupada says, sleep and sickness are maya. trying to stop your service to Krishna. Right? That's why we have to protect the body, stop it from coming sick. It's sick to be, it's maya to become sick, right? Because it stops our service to Krishna. So if we're feeling the body is sick, then we have to do something about it so that we can serve Krishna. And Prabhupada said sleep is also maya, right? Because if you're falling asleep while you should be doing your service, you know, we sleep 6 or 7 hours a day, you know, whatever it takes to keep us healthy and keep our mind and body rested and together. But then when you're awake, you have to be attentive doing your service, right? No extra sleeping. You know, not when you open the Bhagavatam to read, right? And then you read for 2 minutes and then you just, like that, right? And then you wake up half an hour later and that was your reading time. Yeah, that's not good, that's not good. That's maya. If you're having these kind of problems, don't spend so much time by yourself. Get a partner, right? Get a study partner, someone you can read with, right? And keep one ruler in between two of you. And if you fall asleep, you just tap each other. Or whatever, it doesn't have to be before. You just rub them on the shoulder. But the point is, you have to associate with devotees. Right? It's the association of devotees which pulls us through. Because if we leave it to ourselves to overcome the material energy, you cannot take on the material energy. Material energy is way too powerful. Right? So therefore, the only way to become... overcome the material energies by developing a higher taste. So Prahlad Maharaj said to Hiranyakashipu, he said, although you have conquered everywhere in the universe, you have not conquered your senses and you have not conquered your lust. Therefore your human life is not perfect, or your demigod life is not perfect, whatever you are. So how did Hiranyakashipu respond to the good advice from his 5-year-old boy? Right? He threw him on the marble. Right? And he said, kill him. Right? He said to his servants, he said, kill him. Right? Take him and kill him. Right? I don't want a son like this. Right? So then they took him and they threw him under elephants and they threw him off a mountain. They threw him into hot oil. Right? And they did everything to him to try and kill him. And they came back and we said, we can't kill him. Right? We can't kill this boy. Right? He's protected. There's something divine about this personality. Right? So, it is the nature of the conditioned soul when he comes in this material world to be very inimical towards Krishna. That's the nature of the conditioned soul when he comes into this world. So therefore Krishna divides the creation up. He says in the Bhagavad Gita, in the material world there are demons and there are demigods or devotees. Right? In the material world there's devotees, suras and asuras. Right? Demons and devotees. So you see here that sometimes in the same family we'll have a devotee and a demon appearing together, just like Rukmini and Rukmini. So as we said earlier, in Satyayuga, the demons and the demigods were on the different planets. Right? So you had the demigods who sometimes, the demons would sometimes attack the demigods. And then in Treta Yuga, the second Yuga, it says the demons and the demigods were in different countries. So therefore you see in Treta Yuga, who appeared in Treta Yuga? Which incarnation? Lord Ram. And then you'll see the demons and the demigods were in different countries. Right? You saw in Lanka, which was across the ocean, all the Rakshasas, all the demons were living, and then all the devotees lived in a different country, generally, like that. And then in Dwapara Yuga, the third age, then you see the demons and devotees are in different families. Just like in the Mahabharata, that's in Dwapara Yuga, right? Then you'll see the demons and the devotees are in different families, the Pandavas and the Kurus. Right? They come in different families, generally. They'll come. And then in Kali Yuga, you'll see the demons and devotees are in the same body. Yeah. We're in the same body. Right? Adam just freaked out. First time he heard that. Like that. It's nice when you come to the temple and you're a new devotee and you hear things for the first time, you know, and you get that, like, surprise. So now Adam thinks that this Krishna consciousness movement is schizophrenic. Right? We're all got like dual personalities. And factually we do have dual personality. And you'll see that the longer you stay around. No, I didn't mean it in that way. I didn't mean it that way. No. What I meant, although that can be true, but what it means is that you'll see the longer you stay around as a devotee, you'll see that you wake up some mornings and some mornings you wake up and the devotee wakes up. right? And you get up and like everything's wonderful. You know, I can't wait to go to the temple. I can't wait to see Krishna, right? I can't wait to chant my japa. I can't wait for the kirtan. I can't wait for the bhagavatam class. I can't wait for the kirtakoras. I can't wait for, right? Just devotee. And next morning you wake up, and the other guy wakes up, right? That other person is inside your subtle body, the demon, right? And then you think, oh, I don't want to go to the temple. I don't want to go to Mangalati. I don't want to chant my rounds. I don't even want to see a devotee, right? I don't want to hear the Bhagavatam like that. And just totally different. Sometimes you wake up and you just don't want to serve Krishna. Sometimes you wake up and all you want to do is serve Krishna. So in Kali Yuga, the demon and devotee are within the same consciousness. So in Kali Yuga, if you want to overcome your demoniac personality within your consciousness, within your subtle body, your demoniac mind, right, then you have to take shelter of the Yuga avatar. And the Yuga avatar is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Right? Because in Kali Yuga, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he doesn't kill, although he's Krishna himself, he doesn't kill the demons. Right? Krishna killed the demons. But in Mahaprabhu's pastime, he kills the demoniac spirit. Right? That spirit that's within us to rebel against Krishna, Mahaprabhu kills that. And how does he kill that? With the axe. Right? It says in the Chaitanya Mangala, he carries an axe. And what is the axe? Right? Nama Sankirtan. Right? Chanting the Maha Mantra. Hare Krishna,
Hare Krishna, Krishna
Krishna,
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 Krishna, Krishna
Hare Hare,
Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Hare Rama,
Rama. Right? The axe, right, of Nam Sankirtan. Sankirtan means chanting with other devotees. Just like this morning we're having nice kirtan and it cuts the demoniac mentality or that demoniac consciousness that we have to be separate from Krishna. By doing sankirtan, by doing kirtan with the devotees, that demoniac mentality, it gets destroyed by Mahaprabhu's mercy. And one feels like being a devotee, and that's natural. Right? We have to come to that natural point of wanting to be a devotee for Krishna eternally. Right? And when you feel like that, that you want to be eternally a devotee for Krishna, Krishna says, okay, come back. Right? But if you want to stay here and enjoy separately, be a demon some days, you know, once a year I'll have my demon day. I'll go shopping, you know, I'll be a demon, you know, like that. If you want to have that demon, then Krishna says, okay, stay in the material world until you get it out of your system, like that. So here we see that Rukmi and Rukmini are in the same family, but one wants to be a devotee and the other one wants to be a demon. Right? Totally different. Right? All that Rukmini wants to do is be with Krishna. Right? She wants to marry Krishna. That's all she wants. And Rukmi wants to kill him. Right? He's saying here, and how much Maya do you have to be in to think that you can kill God? Right? You have to be in Maya. Right? To think you can kill God. Right? Who do you think you are? Right? If you think you can kill God, then who do you think you are? Right? You must be someone pretty important. Yeah, you must be God Part Two, or you must be, you know, Godzilla, or I don't know who you are. But if you think you can kill God, right? And that's what an atheist is. An atheist is one who denies that God even exists. Right? So who is he? Right? That means he thinks he is God. Right? Because if God does not exist, right, and if he's not the center of creation, then who is the center of creation? It's me. Just like I was doing book distribution in the marathon last December, Swanson Street, I was distributing books, and this one gentleman came up to me. I think he was Irish or something, and he came up to me, and you know, we always give classes. You know, when we give classes, sometimes we talk about the materialists, and we tend to, like, very broadly kind of categorize them. You know, we say, oh, they're all karmis. Right? And then we say, oh, they're all full of material desires. We say they're all lusty. Right? And they're all demons, and they're all thinking, you know, and we just kind of blanket everyone like that. But obviously everyone's not like that. Some people are more or less. But this guy, he was, like, full on. Like, you know, I was surprised. Every time he said something, I was just getting more and more surprised. I'm thinking, this guy's really in Maya. Right? So he came out with something, you know, I'm preaching to him, trying to sell him a book, and he came out with some comment like, you know, I am God. And I looked at him like, you know, yeah, I mean, it's easy to say that, but are you really thinking that? I'm just looking at him, trying to study, and he was like convinced, like he was into it, you know. So he said, I am God. And he said, and you are God too. But you just haven't realized it yet. Right? And then he said, I am God. Yeah, I am the supreme entity. I like that. And I said, oh, that's very good. So I thought I'd hit him back like that, because he was coming out with the big, you know, the big statements, like the big, you know, I will defy God. So, you know, as God's devotees, you know, sometimes we take different tacks. When we preach, we take different tactics sometimes. You know, sometimes we just let it go. We just think, okay, you're an illusion. Have a nice day. You know, nice to meet you. You know, but I thought, you know, on behalf of God, on behalf of Krishna, on behalf of the Lord, I thought I'd give him one back. So he came out with a big sweeping statement, I am God. So I came out with a big sweeping statement, I've never met anyone who's in so much illusion as you. Smacked him. Right? And then we saw, because God, you know, if he was, which I don't think he was, but if he was, right, if he was God, he wouldn't have any false ego. Because God doesn't have a false ego. God is a spiritual entity. He's beyond false ego. But as soon as I said to him, I've never met anyone who is in so much illusion as you, immediately, false ego, fully manifest. And he became very nasty. You know, and who do you think you are? And I started just, you know, just insults like that. So then I, you know, totally exposed. Totally exposed. Not God at all. Right? Just a jiva, just as someone who's under the material. And he walked off, you know, still yelling things back at me, and I just ignored him. You know, just ignored him. You know, you're not even worth listening to, God. You know, pretend God, you know, fake God, like that. So, this is the illusion of the living entity. He thinks that he can remove God. So Rukmi is planning here that he will get back at Krishna. He's building a city, a capital, which he'll amass an army in, and then later on he's going to come and try to crush God, crush Krishna. So we wish Rukmi good luck in his endeavours. Good luck, Rukmi. You know, but we all know that it's not possible. Like that. Krishna has insulted him already. Krishna captured him when he was attacking him, and to insult him, what did he do? Yeah. Because the Kshatriyas are very beautiful, right? The Kshatriyas, because you have the four orders, like that, the Brahmanas, the Vaishyas, the Sudras, the Kshatriyas. Kshatriyas are very beautiful, right? They're very powerful bodies. Their bodies are very powerful, and they're very beautiful people. Right? They're exquisite. The men are very handsome, and the princesses are very beautiful. It's just their breeding. The Kshatriyas are very attractive people. So they have beautiful, like the Kshatriya men, like Arjuna and stuff, they have beautiful black hair, long hair, which they keep beautifully oiled and beautifully tied back. You know, and they're very beautiful, beautiful moustaches, like very powerful, very beautiful to look at, very inspiring. The citizens become inspired just by seeing the Kshatriyas. They're so powerful and they're so beautiful and like that. So it's a big insult to capture one of them. Right, tie him up to a tree and then shave off half his moustache, you know, half his hair. So Krishna shaved off half his moustache, half his hair, and then he let him go. He said, okay, you can go now. By that big insult to a Kshatriya. Right? So then Rukmi was just envious of Krishna. Now I will kill him. Right? Now I will get him back. I'll build a city, I'll amass an army. So this is what happens if you're not going to be a devotee. Right? If you will not surrender to Krishna voluntarily, right, you'll become humiliated. Right? Your pride will be diminished by Krishna. Right? If we don't voluntarily surrender to Krishna, Krishna will diminish our pride. Right? And if we act like Rukmi, right? If we are envious of Krishna and we try to defy Krishna, and we try to rebel against Krishna, even though we're supposed to be devotees, but within our consciousness, if we try to rebel against Krishna, Krishna will diminish our pride. That's all he was doing to Rukmi. It was not... There's nothing defective in what Krishna did. Krishna was just trying to humiliate him, to bring his pride down, so that he could surrender to Krishna, so he could understand that he was supreme, like that. So sometimes we'll see the devotees and the non-devotees are born in the same families, and Krishna will reciprocate with everyone according to the way that they reciprocate with him. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, "Yeyatamam prapajante tamstateva bhajamyaham." As you deal with me, I will deal with you the same way. If you love me, I will love you, right? But if you treat me like an enemy, then I'll become your enemy. And you don't want to make Krishna your enemy. because he's too powerful. So we'll stop here unless there's any questions or comments on what we discussed.
You mentioned all the yogas, etc. And not these yogas, well, Krishna appears in different colours.
Yeah.
And I was wondering why it's always in this council, why always this colour is that of a beautiful rain cloud. So why does Lord Krishna appear, and where does he have the pastimes in a blue, red, black, etc. form?
Which incarnations?
In which yugas?
In which yugas? It's in the 11th canto of the Bhagavad Gita. You have to look it up. It's in the Uddhava Gita when Krishna is instructing Uddhava. He says in such a yuga, because there's the incarnations, the avatars are very complicated, because there's six types of incarnations, right? Guna avatars, yuga avatars, manvantara avatars, lila avatars, shaktivesha avatars, and purusha avatars. So there's six types of avatars. So the yuga avatars, they have four different colours, right? And in Satya Yuga they're white, in Treta Yuga they're red, in Dwapara Yuga is black, and in Kali Yuga is yellow, pitta, like yellow, golden colour. So if you look in the Bhagavatam in the 11th canto, then Krishna explains all this to Uddhava, all the different types of avatars like that. So.
Can I ask one little thing? When the Mahavishnu created, when the universes are created, I know we're discussing in the third canto, but I still can't understand how that you mentioned the subterranean planets in the Nagas and the illuminating. So at which stage were they created, and why do the subterranean Nagas imitate Lord Balaram, you know, which Mahavishnu was? So are they as powerful, or are they reflections, or?
Yeah, no, they're just material creatures who are created in the likeness of God. Just like all over the universe and all the different planets of the universe, there's human-like creatures. Just like we have a human-like form, because Krishna has a human form. Like Krishna's form is human-like, like that. So we get a form like that. That's what the human forms look like all through the planetary systems. And Anantasesh has an eternal form of a snake, like a thousand-hooded serpent. So then they're created in the image of him. Everything that's in this world means it is reflected from the spiritual, like that. So it means that they have this form, they have this material form, they're just snakes. But the origin of that is Seshanak, he is the origin, he is the original snake. Like that. So there you go.
Yeah.
Is there something else you wanted to know?
No, I think you add little bits if you ask the question, and eventually somehow the whole picture comes together.
Yeah.
You know, because I have limited understanding.
Yeah, it's very complicated. The whole creation is like a
big
subject.
You were mentioning this example of pulling out the thorn with another thorn. So in regards to applying that for the attraction to the opposite sex, couldn't we say that, you know, that tendency for being attached to the opposite sex could also be used for one's advancement in such a way, not only by getting married, but in such a way that we bring that principle on a higher platform, that we get attached to a great soul of the opposite sex?
No, I wouldn't say it's the same thing, because that's not a material attachment. It's not a material attachment. That relationship is different. That's a spiritual relationship.
But in the beginning, because our heart is not pure, there might be, you know, some pure element there, like, you know, the very common thing is for young girls, the attachment and attraction to guru is not that pure, really, you know?
Yeah.
But in that way, that principle leads one to upliftment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Principle of shelter, because women need protection. And every woman needs to be dependent upon a male figure, as you say. So then, just like sometimes in the early days of ISKCON, Prabhupada would arrange the marriages, and then sometimes the husband would leave or something like that, and the wife was left with a male son, with a son, and then they would say, should we get remarried? And Prabhupada would say, you can become like, or put your full attachment onto the son. And if you put the full attachment of the sun, that will satisfy your desire. You didn't say it had to be like that, but it could satisfy your desire. So then you could, you know, progress in your Krishna consciousness. So the nature of the woman, she has to be attached to a man, as you said. So it may be the guru figure, who is like the, becomes everything for the woman in terms of the service attitude is reposing onto that person. And that is the shelter or the ashraya of the woman. But it is not, it's not the same as towards the husband. Because there's that material feeling, that has to be removed. Because it's obviously it's different, but the taking the shelter is the same. So therefore it says within the Vedic culture, then the woman is always protected by the father, then the husband, then the eldest son. So she's always protected, and she always needs that protection. So then, in the absence of Vedic culture, in the absence of Krishna conscious families, then the woman could become fully attached to the guru, and that would be okay, and that would lead her to liberation like that. But it won't have any of the element of the husband, that bath or that feeling, that won't be within that relationship.
Yeah, no, I meant simply, you know, redirecting this principle
attachment.
Of attachment and attraction, redirecting with, yeah. And bringing it on a different platform.
Yeah, yeah. So that's how it would work, that dynamics.
Also, I wanted to make another comment about your thing about, you know, Wi-Fi, you know, and association between brahmacharya and dreams. This is actually a very serious problem, you know. There was just a little bit of a stable and wonderful action in this regard, where 200 mobile phones were confiscated of the brahmacharis. Because, you know, that mobile phone really got them into trouble, and there was incidences where brahmacharis and mindful, they actually had full ongoing relationships. So then they were checking out the mobile phones, and they saw that so many of the brahmacharis were ringing and communicating with young girls, so there was a whole big scandal in that regard. And also in other countries, I have this observation that this mobile phone really, you know, leads to illicit association. You know? So in that regard, it was funny when I was recently in Bangladesh, there was this big advertisement post of the Dhaka, you know, for a mobile phone company. And there was this two young girls on the picture and one young guy, you know, happily associating. And then the motto was, it brings people together. So, and this is really what is happening, you know. brings people, you know, in an unwanted way in Krishna consciousness together. So...
has to be cautioned.
We cannot underestimate this, you know, in this. These modern technology things, they have to really be used with controlled senses, otherwise it really becomes a trap. And in that regard, there's also this kind of little story with Prabhupada where just the telex machine came out, and the devotees were very, you know, proudly showing to Prabhupada, oh, our temple has a telex machine somewhere in America, you know? And then one of Prabhupada's disciples was saying, oh, Prabhupada, maybe every temple should have one of those telex machines, you know, and then we can communicate. And then Prabhupada very strongly was saying, no, otherwise you will just talk Punjabi all over the planet, all over the world, you know.
Now we have internet.
Yes, so sometimes I'm wondering, you know, if Prabhupada would think about internet.
Yeah, so, Prabhupada would use it in Krishna service, but then the danger is that, you know, devotees waste a lot of time just sending emails. And
you can really see it. You know,
people really it's a big thing.
Waste half their life and ruin their sadhana just with being, you know, really like addicted to internet.
Yeah, so one has to, everything one does has to be under the guidance of guru. Like that, always has to be directly under the guidance of guru. Otherwise, then one becomes independent. And if you become independent, then you become subject to your own mind. And then your own mind will lead you away from Krishna because you're attracted to the material energy still. So the guru always has to be, everything has to be checked like that. And in terms of brahmacharinism, brahmacharya sending like text messages and that kind of thing, don't be a hypocrite. You know, there should not be any hypocrisy. Like, if you're going to be a brahmachari or a brahmacharini, you know, there has to be some arrangements made for marriage or something. Go through the proper channels like that. That's what I did. You know, when it was time for me to get married, then I started going through the proper channels. Yeah, you know, I didn't have, like, you know, relationships going with brahmacharinis and text messages, and that's nonsense. Don't be a hypocrite. Because then it just brings our whole movement. Prabhupada said purity is the force. Right? So it just dissolves all the purity. Right? And then it just becomes, you know, within the spiritual purity becomes compromised, and then everything becomes weak like that and becomes materialistic, and devotees conscious, the whole movement will go down like that. Any other questions or comments?
One small comment about somebody said that I don't believe in God. Prabhupada said that whose tongue you're speaking, I don't believe in God. It's only by God's mercy I'm able to speak. And then you're saying you don't believe in God. How are you speaking?
Yeah, that's a good point. It's funny because you see people who say there is no God, they can become very forceful and very emotional about this fact that there's a no God. Like that. So if he doesn't exist, then what's your problem? You know, if he's not there, then what are you getting so worked up about? You know, just like Gunagrahi Maharaj, one time he was preaching in a college in America, and one professor was giving a whole lecture, right? And he basically was like supporting like Darwin's theory of evolution, that there's no God. And then at the end, you know, Gunagrahi put his hand up and he, you know, politely challenged him. He said that, you know, you're saying there is no God, but, you know, we see that, you know, all around us there is order within the universe. Just basic arguments like we always preach to people. And this professor just became angry. And he started saying, there is no God. There is no God. And Gurdjieff Goswami, well, there's no God, then what's the problem? You know? Why are you so angry? Like that. There's no God, then there's no problem. Just be happy and go about your life. But they've got to get so emotionally attached to disproving that he doesn't exist. And that's why you'll see in Prabhupada's books, because, like, you know, we're teaching the course in the temple, and we're teaching the Bhagavatam, we're studying it systematically, we're going through chapter by chapter, canto by canto. And one of the main things Prabhupada does in his purports again and again and again is just smash Mayavada philosophy. Right? So why does Prabhupada, and so I used to think, why does Prabhupada put so much emphasis on Mayavada philosophy? Because it doesn't even bother me, really. I read Prabhupada's books a lot, and I don't even really have a thing about Mayavada philosophy. It hardly enters my mind. I don't even, you know, really think about it. So I think, why does Prabhupada put so much emphasis on it? Because of this reason. Because they're denying God's existence. Right? And to deny God's existence, it's actually a great offence towards Krishna. Right? Just like if someone ignores you, how do you feel? Right? If someone just ignores you and just, you know, and will not admit that you exist, right? How does it make you feel? Right? And that's what a Mayavadi does to Krishna. Right? You just don't exist. Right? So Krishna does not appreciate like that. So therefore the philosophy must be very forcefully challenged. Like that, because at this point in time, Mayavada philosophy has taken over Earth. Basically, all through India, it's prominent, and all over the West, it's prominent in different forms. So we have to challenge it strongly. Like that, challenge it like very, very heavily. Just like one time, Prabhupada was in South India, a big Pandal program, and Prabhupada was asked to speak, and there was also some Mayavada gurus who had been invited to speak also. So Prabhupada spoke, and Prabhupada, you know, spoke about Krishna and like that. Spoke about, you know, Krishna being supreme. And then Prabhupada, you know, sat down, and then one of the Mayavada gurus came up. And the first thing he practically said was that there is no God. We are all one. So Prabhupada looked to his disciples, he said, start kirtan. It wasn't even Prabhupada's program. It wasn't even an ISKCON program. Prabhupada had just been invited. But he started preaching, like, you know, Mayavada philosophy, and Prabhupada said, start kirtan. So devotees just started kirtan, no one could hear what he was saying. Prabhupada just disgusted. Start kirtan. Srila Prabhupada ki.